Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
I'm Manny.
And this is your New Comics Wednesday episode for January 6, 2021. We got a ton of books to talk about. A ton. Future State kicked off. We had the end of Death Metal as well. A ton of great Marvel books, some pretty cool independents as well. So just a reminder, everybody, it's spoiler-free. For this New Comic Wednesday, so you can have a chance to read the books. But we are going to be doing Future State Fridays starting this Friday. This Friday's episode will be kind of a what do you need to know in order to read Future State? And Nick Dahl from various podcasts at LRM Online will be joining me since he had no idea what was going on in DC and he wanted to read Future State. If you don't know what you need to read for Future State and you don't think you're going to have time to listen to the episode on Friday, I'll tell you, you can go into Future State cold, you can buy all the issues, and supposedly you don't need to know anything. But if you do want to know kind of the overall state of the DC universe, things that go on and the end of Death Metal and what Future State is and what it's going to look like, what Infinite Frontier, which is kind of the new state of DC going forward, starting in March. If you want to know all that stuff, then definitely tune in for Friday's episode. And then if you want to dive deep into the various Future State titles, be sure you join us every Friday for the next couple months when we'll go over all those Future State books in detail. Plenty of spoilers abound. So you've been warned. If you join us for Future State Fridays, there will be spoilers. All right, let's dive into this week's books. Manny, what do you got?
I'm going to start off with Eternals number one, written by Kieran Gillian. With art by Asad Ribic, colors by Matthew Wilson. So I was excited just because of the fact that I don't know much about the Eternals, other than the fact that there's a film coming out from Marvel Studios and that they were created by the one and only Jack Kirby. Let me guess.
After reading Eternals number one from Kieran Gillen, you still don't know much about the Eternals.
I have no idea what was going on. this book, it's jumping around and doing things and so confused. So I did a little research on it. It turns out that this book was supposed to come out hand in hand with the film. And because of certain things that happened, that just didn't work out. And here we are. The other thing is that Marvel being Marvel, they released this book with 40 variant covers. 40.
Of course they did.
Oh, my God. I can't really talk much about it because I didn't even find the artwork to be very good. You know what it feels like? It feels like a teenage what's the name of the artist who did EXO for a long time? LaRosa?
Louis LaRosa?
Yeah. It's like a teenage version of Louis LaRosa's art. That's what I feel like.
So I'm not a big fan of the Eternals. And you shouldn't feel bad that you were lost. Because I do know the history of the Eternals, but even I would have a hard time explaining it because they have a really convoluted history and it's been changed, like comics tend to do over time, really kind of out there. So quick and dirty, they're created by the Celestials. Celestials came to Earth when there wasn't even humans yet. And they kind of messed around with various life forms and eventually ended up creating the Eternals and their offshoot, the Deviants. And the Eternals and Deviants have always kind of been at odds with each other, because the Eternals are kind of like the epitome of human evolution and they have powers. They kind of can channel the power cosmic, and Deviants are ugly and deformed and kind of monstrous looking. And so there's jealousy there. And the Eternals are supposed to be like the kind of the shepherds or the protectors of humankind. And so they don't want the Deviants around because they think the Deviants make them look bad. And like, that's not how humans are supposed to look, even though the Deviants aren't human. But there's all kinds of other changes that have been made over the years, and they are eternal and they die and they come back. And so it is, they do have a kind of a really wonky history. I'm sure the MCU movie is going to kind of explain it and have it more simplified. And this book, like Manny said, was supposed to tie into that. So that being said, I think that if you do pick this up and read it and just glean what you can from reading it, like spend some time reading it, that and don't try to just power through it, that you will get some things from it. It is enjoyable. It's not Esad Ribic's best work by any means. I don't know what it is, because his art is can be really, really good. And I would point to the Infinity series he did about Thanos and the Black Order, where his art is like spectacular. So he does have some really good art at various times, but this wasn't his best work. And yeah, it can be confusing, but I think there is value there. But certainly wouldn't recommend going out and trying to get all 40 covers. Yeah, that's pretty ridiculous. Pretty ridiculous. All right, well, let me start off with my first book. I'm going to talk about Iron Man first. Iron Man number 5 from writer Christopher Cantwell, art by Kafu, colors by Frank DiArmada, letters by Joe Caramagna. We finally get I don't want to say the reject team, but so Iron Man is battling Korvac. He's been working with Hellcat, Patsy Walker, and they realize that Korvac is trying to, we found this out last issue, Korvac is trying to basically invade Galactus's ship, his home mother world ship, whatever he calls it, his home world, Dao 2, it's called, T-A-U 2, because he had one previously that got destroyed, so this is the second version. Anyway, he's trying to go there and supposedly steal the power from Galactus, because Korvac, you know, previously he was started out as a human, but then he gained the power of a god. He wants to basically remake the universe and make it perfect, you know, whatever that means to him. He's killed all the Avengers before. He's a very powerful villain, and I'm really surprised that nobody's brought him back before now. But he's back, but he's in android form, and he's clearly nowhere near as powerful as he used to be, so that's why he wants to go and steal Galactus's power. So Tony and Hellcat know this. They took on Korvac, and they kind of got their butts kicked a couple issues ago, and now they're trying to put together a team really quickly in order to fight against Korvac. But when it's got to be on the down low, because Korvac has James Rhodes held hostage. And again, we found all this out over the last couple issues. I'm not talking about anything that happens in this issue. This is not spoilers. But he does have to put together a team, and he can't just put out the call to any big names, because Korvac will find out. And so he has to put together what I would say is a pretty ragtag team. I won't spoil who it is, even though it's been out there on social media. But they're not your household names. They're not even, I wouldn't even call them B-list. I mean, we're like down in like the Z-list almost with these characters, but it's kind of cool to see them. They haven't been seen in a long time. So other than that, I can't really say anything that happens as far as the events of the issue. But what I will say is I love the back and forth. I love the dialogue. I love the banter that Christopher Cantwell brings to comics. You know, he's from the world of television, and the creator and showrunner of Halt and Catch Fire, which is a show that has great dialogue as well. And so it's not a surprise that he's really good at dialogue. If there's anything I can nitpick, and believe me, this is, I'm definitely picking at nits here, because I'm a big fan of Christopher. I think he does a great job. But I know he the story that he wants to tell with Iron Man is a big story. And so the pacing is a little bit choppy, but only because he's trying to put so much in here. And the other part of it would be the art by Kafu, which is really, really good. But Kafu's art, I don't want to use the word widescreen, but you definitely want to see it. You know what I mean? Like you can't do like 9 panel pages and 12 panel pages, because you want to see his art. Like you want to see the detail, you want to see his line work, because he's so good. And you know, there's big explosions and a lot of action, and those need big panels. And when you do that, you know, you lose out on real estate in the book to actually tell the story. So in a perfect world, each of these issues of Iron Man that we're getting from Cantwell and Kafu would be like 30 pages. And I'm sure Christopher would love that, because then he'd get to let the story breathe a little more. So that saying, it is fast paced, and there's a lot that happens in each issue. But I do wish the story got a chance to breathe a little more, because that's the thing. It's like Christopher Cantwell is telling this big epic story with Iron Man versus Korvac, which is just this, you know, this huge, these two huge power levels, characters going against each other. But then in the background of that, you've also got the character story of Tony trying to get back to his roots. You know, it's Tony Stark being Tony Stark for the first time in Marvel Comics in like over a decade. Tony Stark is no longer acting like Robert Downey Jr. in the comics, which I love. I absolutely love, because I was a huge Iron Man fan before Robert Downey Jr. And I didn't really like that Tony Stark started acting, you know, smug and cracking jokes and all that, because that wasn't who he was previously. So Christopher Cantwell's bringing that Tony Stark back, and I'm interested enough just to read that story. But like I said, it's hard to fit that subplot in with the big epic story he's telling. Like I said, another, even if it was 5 or 6 pages an issue, it would definitely benefit. But I highly recommend it if you're an Iron Man fan, or if you haven't been reading Iron Man because you haven't been a fan of like the snarkiness, the snarky Starky of Robert Downey Jr., then give this a try, because it's definitely a different feel. All right, what do you have up next, Manny?
Up next, I have Future State, Harley Quinn number 1. And in a nutshell, I really like this. Part of it actually has to do with kind of the cartoon anime kind of style art by artist Simeon DeMille. It was just fun to look at, actually. And like, his artwork has a lot of movement to it, and it almost felt like I was reading an animated show, and I like that about it. It's written by Stephanie Phillips, and it is colored by Tamara Bonvillain. And so, excuse me. It was really simple. Obviously, we're in Future State, so we're dealing with the magistrate in Gotham, who we learn a little bit more about throughout the books. But in this case, Harley Quinn's actually being caught, which I kind of find a little hard to believe. But I guess if everybody's out on their own, it kind of makes a little bit more sense. So
makes no sense, man. Heroes in Crisis, she took on Wonder Woman, Batman, and Superman and escaped. And you're going to tell me some non-superpowered people catch her?
She's got some age. She's 5 years in the future. She's a little rusty. Anyway, she's captured, and now in an interesting twist, Crane, I can't remember his full name. I don't understand. Jonathan effing Crane, aka the Scarecrow, is now running the place and is trying to take out other masked vigilantes. So he makes her a deal. If she can help him take down certain criminals, she'll get certain things. And it was pretty good. The end got a little weird, but it was cool, kind of, because like, okay, I really like Professor Pig for whatever stupid reason, but so it was cool to usually, like, it's like anytime you see Professor Pig anywhere, it's just like for a moment. And even in Tom King's run, it was like it was a dream. It wasn't even real. And so it was cool to see that. Like, it was a different type of mask also. It was like more like high tech kind of. So it was kind of cool. But overall, it was just fun. Like, it was a like book of the week. Like, no, but it's better than kind of the Harley Quinn I've seen lately. And I think it's because she's away from Batman, and that's just what makes her kind of a little bit more fun. Plus, she uses her psychiatric analysis in order to be able to help Crane try to take down some of these other Gothamites, as I'll call them. So good.
Yeah, I didn't like it.
It wasn't like I said, it was just fun.
Yeah, and again, join us for Future State Friday, not this Friday, but next Friday. It gives you 10 whole days to read it. But I'll go into my reasons for not liking it there in more detail. But, you know, Stephanie Phillips, she's been on the show several times, and I think she's a very talented writer. She hasn't been around for a long time, so it's kind of surprising to see her on such a high profile character. But you know, kudos to her for getting the gig. But I don't know, the pacing is mostly what I
really,
and I don't know that I can blame her for that necessarily, because, and you know, again, we'll get into this on Future State Friday, but these Future State books were supposed to be 5G. So it was supposed to be, they're supposed to have, you know, God knows how many issues to tell the stories and get out the ideas they wanted to get out. So it could have been that each of the villains that she helps Crane take down, that would have been an issue, but maybe she's trying to cram it all in. She only gets two issues to tell the story. So I just thought the pacing. This was actually the first Future State book I read, and I was like, oh, I don't know. And I didn't care for the art either. So that was another point against it for me.
I like it. I like the art.
Yeah. So anyway, let me move on to my next book. I'm going to talk about, you want to talk about fun books. Let's talk about a really fun book. So from Marvel, issue 2 of MODOK, written by Jordan Bloom and Patton Oswalt. Yeah, that's right. I said Patton Oswalt, the comedian, the actor. You may know him from King of Queens, or you might know him as the voice of Remy from Ratatouille, or he plays, I think he plays the vice principal on AP Bio. I've never seen the show. I want to see it.
He's also one of the co-hosts in Mystery Science Theater 3000.
There you go. Have you watched AP Bio?
No, I haven't.
Oh, I heard it's really funny. So he's either the principal or the vice principal. Anyway, I'm a fan of his, and he's a huge fan of comics. I don't know, I think a lot of people don't realize that. And so he's getting a chance to write a Marvel comic. So I'm like, I got to check it out. And I've always been, I mean, I'm not like a huge MODOK fan. Like, I'll read anything that he's in, but I think he's an interesting character. And just the idea of this giant head, because if you've seen him, he floats around in this little like special suit that he wears, because his head is so big, his body can't even support it. Like, his head is like 3 times or 10 times bigger than his body. And he just has these little arms and little legs that, you know, can't possibly support him. So he just looks funny. And I mean, even his name, I couldn't tell you what the acronym is anymore. I used to know it at one time, but it's like something like mental organism. Oh, that's what it is. Mental organism designed only for killing. That's why it's MODOK. And I think it's changed over time, but anyway, he's just a funny character. And in the first issue, he basically has kind of a breakdown, because he's sort of this computerized brain kind of organism that's, you know, supposed to be super smart and be able to plan all these heists. And he's working for AIM or Hydra, usually is how it goes. And I think in this one, he's working for AIM. And he basically, he has this breakdown where he's having these memories come back of like being married and having like a daughter. He has a daughter that has a giant head, but his wife is normal, like a normal human, which I can only imagine the amount of pain if she actually birthed somebody that had a head that was bigger than her entire body. Like, it's not even possible, right? But it's just funny. This is totally out of continuity. It's just pure fun. It's just, you know, MODOK being totally mustache twirling and fun and just saying totally off the wall kind of stuff. And in this issue, he teams up with Iron Man. And the banter back and forth between MODOK and Tony Stark is fun. And it's just, I don't want to say much more about the actual events that happen in this issue, because I don't want to spoil anything. But their team up and the things that they do, they go on this mission together. And even the, you know what? I'm not even going to say it. I'm not even going to say it, because I enjoyed it when it happened. And I don't want to spoil it for you. But I'll just say that there are like little Easter eggs that show up throughout the issue that are just fun. I'm like, Patton Oswalt is a comic, you know, he's a professional comedian. So you expect this to be funny, and it doesn't disappoint. It's just a fun comic. It doesn't take itself too seriously. This isn't a comic you're going to read and go, oh, well, you know, how come Tony Stark is this, when in the regular Iron Man series from Christopher Cantwell, he's over here doing this right now and his armor is different and blah. You're not going to, no, this is not about continuity. This is not about where does this fit in the MODOK timeline. This is just like a fun Marvel comic with some cool jokes. And the artwork is done pretty well. Like, it suits the type of lighthearted story that they're telling. So the artwork by Chris Hepburn is done really well. And the colors by Carlos Lopez are very bright and vibrant, like you would expect in kind of a humor comic. And then the letters by Travis Lanham are done really well. And Travis, he gets to go beyond just doing the normal word balloons with people talking, because MODOK has a lot of internal dialogue. And even while he's even within that internal dialogue, like he's having like the computerized internal dialogue, you know, as he's normally thinking things out to himself, he also has this other voice in his head, which is kind of that glitch or that, you know, malfunction that he's having, where it's like a different voice in his head. And so it's in a different colored box with a different font. And so Travis Lanham gets to do that also. So I really recommend this. It's just a really, really fun comic. I mean, again, I'm a fan of Patton Oswalt, but not like a giant fan. Like I see everything that he's in, but I know what a great comic fan he is. So I was curious. And so I picked up the first issue and I liked it enough to read the second one. And now I'm in, man. After the second issue, I am so in. This is so fun. And, you know, having Iron Man show up and the kind of the caper they go on. Yeah, I'm definitely in. This is a really great comic. all right, Manny, what do you have up next?
Up next, I had something. Aftershocks. Where'd it go?
Well, there's
two. All right, it is. Knock 'em Dead, number 2.
Okay.
From Aftershock Comics. This is written by Elliot Raw, with art by Mattia Monaco and colors by Matt Miller. The cover was done by Andy Clark with Jose Villarrubia. The reason why I mentioned that, because it is a freaky, weird, cool cover. It's also kind of gross. All mixed into one. So I suggest checking it out.
There's two covers. They're both really great.
I think I've only seen one.
The one where he's wearing the like Groucho Marx disguise?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's another one where it's just looking at him. You're on the stage looking out toward the crowd, and he's standing on the stage holding a microphone, and you see the crowd, but the crowd is all skeletons, and all the skeletons have their mouths open and they're laughing and clapping.
Oh, that one I haven't seen.
Hold on, I'll show it to you because it looks really cool also. Can you see it?
Oh yeah, that is pretty cool.
Yeah, so I think both the covers are really outstanding.
Yeah, definitely. So last issue, we saw that our main character Prior Bryce died for a bit because he was in a really bad car accident with his friend, quote unquote, Danny Barron, and we had seen him trying to become a comedian, and it just wasn't working. He wasn't very funny, but his friend was going to help him with it, and he was going to get better. His sister is trying to egg him on, but at the same time, he needs to trying to also get him to get a job to do something with his life, because he wasn't being very productive. But then at the events of the end of the issue were with the car crash, he pretty much dies. And in the beginning of the issue, we see the doctors or nurses talking to his sister, saying that there are some events, so there's some really weird things going on where he should be dead, but he's not. We couldn't find a pulse, but his heart's fine. We couldn't get a temperature. But we also see that while he's knocked out, he starts having visions with his deceased friend, and they come up with a deal where he's gonna help him with his comedy, but he doesn't understand the consequences of what that is. And I think that's something that we're gonna be exploring, and something that has consequences that I'm not going to talk about. But it is very interesting, because as you progress through the issue, you start seeing a couple little changes in him that his sister notices right away. And you get a little bit more exposition on his sister and kind of Ronnie, who is working at a used car lot, and you kind of see the goofball that she works for, who just kind of even the way that he's drawn, where he's just kind of sitting back with his legs open, it's just, and I think the whole time he's drawn with his eyes closed, kind of to even just show that laziness that the guy, you know, the sleazeball that he is. But so you get a little bit of why, you know, why she kind of gets on him, or why, because, you know, obviously she's been struggling. But solid second issue. The only thing I will say about it is I don't really care for the artwork that much, and it's mainly because the lack of emphasis on faces, and I just wish there was a little bit more detail in them. But it's just kind of, a lot of them just kind of seem like line. It doesn't look like much, and but it's a good issue. I like it. I think Rawl puts out some good stuff. I'm just really curious what the direction of the entire series really is, because I understand he wants to become a comic, but what's going to be the implication of having this, the spirit of his dead friend help him, and where does it all go together? So it's a fun, like, I don't know where it's going, but I'm very, very interested.
Yeah, the second issue kind of threw me with the way it ended, and the blurb for next issue. So I don't know where it's going either, which is strange to say after two issues. Like, normally that would be a reason for me to maybe not keep going. Like, after two issues, I kind of want to know. Yeah. That's the thing about Elliot Rahal's work. He, like, his character interactions and the dynamics between the characters are so interesting and so real that you, like, I want to see. Like, I feel like, not that the stand-up is the background of this book or the setting for it, but I feel like the backbone of the story is the relationship between Pryor and his sister.
Right.
That's what has me hooked right now. So we'll see what happens with the stand-up stuff. The art, yeah, I kind of feel the same way. The art isn't really, it's not impactful enough for me. Like we're just talking about how great those two covers are.
Mm-hmm.
Those are impactful covers. Like, that's art that says something. Inside, the art is a little less dynamic, and so I feel like it's not grabbing me. So, but still worth reading for sure. All right, let me see. What am I going to talk? Let's talk about Dark Knight's Death Metal number 7.
Wow.
An Anti-Crisis Part 7: A Slap in the Face by Scott Skullcrusher Snyder and Greg Constrictor Capullo, with inks by Jonathan Gutpunch Glapion, colors by FCO Plastique Placencia, and there's a whole heck of a lot of other creators as well. Pencils and inks on pages 29 through 36, Yannick Yellmaster Paquette. Pages 37 and 38, pencils and inks by Brian Hatchetman Hitch. Colors for 29 through 36, Nathan Fist of Steel Fairbairn. And colors on 37 through 38 by Alex Slicer Sinclair. Letters are by Tom Negaton Napolitano. So this is the big one, the big enchilada, what everything has been leading up to for the past, God, I don't even remember now, 8 August? July? Like, I don't even remember when the first, maybe it was before that, right? Because it was delayed. The first issue was supposed to come out, and then it got delayed because of COVID and it came out later. So I guess it was supposed to be in March or April. But anyway, you know, a lot of issues of Dark Knight Death Metal, a lot of one-shots, a lot of anthologies, a lot of tie-ins, and it's all led up to this. And I will say that I've talked about it many times. This is a very messy event. It feels messy. It is messy. It's all over the place with Snyder and Capullo throwing everything in the kitchen sink at the wall to see what sticks. Oh, here's Batman who's crossed with a castle. Here's Batman who's crossed with a Batmobile. Here's Batman who's crossed with a Tyrannosaurus Rex from the Batcave. At least they didn't cross him with the Batpenny. That's about the only thing they didn't cross him with. But it's been really, really messy. It has gotten better, I feel like, as and the story has tightened up as it's gone along. So I certainly do appreciate that. And this final issue, it's pretty straightforward. And I think that a lot of that has to do with the fact that the last two crossovers or one shots that they did, they kind of showed us, okay, here's what's happening in all the other fights. You know, like we saw here's what's happening in the Bat Family fight. Here's what's happening in the Teen Titans and who they're fighting against. Here's what's happening with the Superman family fighting. And so they didn't have to spend any time in this issue on any of that stuff. We just got to focus on Wonder Woman and the Batman Who Laughs and kind of their final confrontation. And so in the end, it does end up being a Wonder Woman story. Obviously, I'm not going to get into the details of it because I'm not going to spoil it. We probably will get into the details of it at some point, maybe talk a little bit about it on the first Future State Friday, where we talk about books. So that'll be not this coming Friday, but the following Friday. But all that being said, I mean, it wraps up in a way that makes sense. And it wraps up in such a way that everything does count and everything does matter. The one thing that I kind of hoped that it would do that it didn't, it just didn't catch that lightning in a bottle. Remember when everybody read Rebirth, when Wally West came back and that sort of fixed the new 52, fixed the problem that even Jim Lee and Dan Didio admitted that the mistake they made was the new 52 is they removed the connections and the emotional relationships that made the DC universe special and gave it its charm.
Yeah. It's called DCU.
Yeah. And it felt like it was restored, that emotional connection of the DC universe between its characters and between the fans and those characters was restored by Geoff Johns by bringing Wally West back. And it was very impactful. And you heard about people reading Rebirth and, you know, having tears in their eyes and just being really impacted. You would hope with a story as big as Death Metal has been and it now saying, okay, now everything counts. Every story ever told in any DC universe story, it all matters. Like basically Crisis didn't erase anything. Crisis on Infinite Earths didn't erase anything. Final Crisis, Zero Hour, Infinite Crisis, like none of them erased anything. Everything happened. So everybody has the possibility. Any character that's dead previously has the possibility to come back. And they literally say as much in the issue. So you would think that a story like that would have some emotional impact and you would feel something.
Yep.
I didn't feel anything. It was like, all right, so I guess Death Metal's over and everything's saved.
I felt relief it was over.
It does have some cool ideas though about like the future going forward. Like there's, again, I'm not going to spoil, but there's something on the other side of the moon that was a big deal. We do find out that now instead of a multiverse, there's an omniverse. So not only are there the 52 Earths of the Grant Morrison multiverse, but there's new Earths being created. And then there's also different versions of those other Earths in other multiverses. So maybe you have Earth 1, and I don't know, like, how are they even going to designate? Like, 1. So you have 1. Earth 1, Earth 2, Earth 3.
1.35.
Well, no, when you go, okay, well, this is Earth 1A, and this is Earth 1B, because it's over in a different multiverse, but it's still Earth 1. So then, we got, I mean, they really have.
Dark Universe, it's -1.
Yeah, they've opened up like infinite possibilities for stories, and it is an easy way for them to say everything counts, every. You know, if you're, how does this fit in here or whatever? It doesn't make sense. Well, it happened not only on another Earth, maybe it happened on the same Earth, but that Earth in a different multiverse. So you're saying, wait, this happened. This is Batman of Earth 1. And how does that timeline, doesn't make sense for Batman of Earth 1. Well, no, this happened Batman of Earth 1 Alpha multiverse. And this has happened to Batman of Earth 1, but Beta multiverse. So Earth 1A versus Earth 1B. And again, you can make anything count and you can make it all fit together. But I think really what DC is saying here is everything counts. Don't feel like anything you read doesn't count because, you know, some fans get upset about that. Well, I love this character and then it got erased. Why did I bother reading? Everything matters now, whether that means people will care and keep reading, who knows? But the other thing I think they're saying is just don't think about the continuity too much. Don't think too hard because there's no way for DC to reconcile it all now. Because the bottom line is when you talk about characters like Batman and Superman, and Wonder Woman that have been around for over 75 years, the characters are only like what, in their 30s or 40s. It literally can't make sense. They've been around far too long, and Batman's had how many different Robins by now? He can't be as old as he is and have had like 6 or 7 different Robins. It would make him too old. So you can't think about it too much. You just got to take it all with a grain of salt and just say, hey man, tell good stories. And that's basically what they set up here in Death Metal. So it ended up better than I expected, like based on the quality of the first two issues, I'll say. I didn't expect myself to like it as much as I did. It's still super messy. And when you compare it to another event that's like makes more sense and is structured better, then the flaws in it become even more apparent. And I just think that Scott Snyder is not the right kind of writer to be doing an event this big. It doesn't play to his strengths, I feel, because I think he has so many big ideas, too many big ideas. He tries to fit too much stuff in. And there's not the real estate. There's not, you can't explain it. It doesn't, the narrative doesn't flow. So did it end up better than I expected? Yes. Is it as good as it could have been? No. But it does set up an interesting situation for the DC universe going forward. And I said this on another, you'll hear it when I talk about the state of the DCU on our first Future State Friday, this coming Friday. We're not even going to know really what the tone and the feel of the DC universe is until like May or June of this year, after we get a few months of Infinite Frontier under our belts and see what it's all about. So anything else you want to add about Death Metal, Manny? I guess I should say the art I thought was solid. Having Paquette and Hitch and the other artists on here were great. I mean, it's Capullo art. So yeah, I thought the art was all done really, really well.
So like the final battle between the two was kind of really bland, I felt, because it almost felt like in a very, very simplistic way, the Joker who last punched her and then she punched him back. That's kind of what happened.
Yeah, sure. Fight over.
Because if you know, it's like, he's like, She punched him way back into Jurassic Park, and then she's like, she punched him right back into reality, into the, you know, whatever. And I was like, oh. And then the only thing it's weird because it's such a Wonder Woman centric story, but there's so much Batman.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's so like time, like. I don't, I think that's the part that really, that kind of leaves a little bit of sour note for me personally, is that I like the idea of where it ended up with Wonder Woman, but there's so much Batman that they cram down your throat the whole time that it really gets a little bit lost, I feel. And I think that they could have done a little bit of a better job at maybe adding some more of her mythology and some of the themes maybe. But there's just so much, you know, and this is coming from Batman's my favorite superhero, but they just cram so much of it like down your throat that it just kind of, I really feel like you really had something here. And I just think it needed to be just a little bit better executed. Because it could have, I liked where it ended up with her character personally, and the reasoning that the conversation happens and she finds out certain things. I thought that was really, I liked it. For Wonder Woman as a character, I thought that was great. But you know, just too much, like you were saying, too much Batman.
Yeah.
And if I take anything from this, is that it's over, and hopefully this fall we're not hearing about Death Metal Future State. And I say that and I start to sweat a little bit because you know they can do it. but
oh yeah. Yeah. See, the Batman Who Laughs will be showing up in the Joker series any day now.
Oh my God, that would be so, that'd be so bad. Anyway, like, yeah, like, and it's sad because like in I've got to see a couple of events like this already, and this is probably the worst one that I've read. So there's, I wish there was more I wanted to say about it, but.
Well, what book do you have up next?
Oh yeah, it's my turn. Future State, Wonder Woman, number one. Written and artwork by the lovely, talented, Eisner Award nominated Joelle Jones. And it's with artwork by Jordi Belair. So obviously, this just, we don't have to talk about the artwork because it's fabulous. I think it's fabulous. I love the way that she draws our newest Amazonian, Flora Yara. Wait, where is it? Yeah, Flora. Yeah, that's her name is. And again, I don't know if it's just because I know that these are just kind of, you know, one shots or whatever, but, or just for 2 months, but I liked it. I liked her introduction, her character introduction, and she's actually a big deal because the CW is developing a whole series around this character right here, Yara Flor. And so even if, so obviously it's impossible to think that we're not going to get more of her in DC Comics after this, but as far as kind of, you know, her snarky attitude that was introduced, her kind of punch now, ask questions later, you know, it's a little bit, that's who she is. That's who she's going to be. And so fine. I liked it. So this book, it's set in the Amazonian rainforest in Brazil, obviously. And it kicks off with Yara taking on a Hydra. And the whole reason behind this whole ploy is because she wants to kill a Hydra, take its horn, and threaten Hades to release one of her sister warriors who is held captive down there. In the meantime, she's also assisted by Caipora, who is a Brazilian mythological figure that rides a peccary. And she's in mythology. She prevents poaching, which is actually what she tries to do in this case with the Hydra. It's interesting because it's kind of a little bit comical the way that they depict the entrance to Hades to the underworld. And so I had some fun with it. I thought it was great, and it was a little bit more comical than I thought it would be. And I think that's why I enjoyed it, because it didn't have as serious of a tone as I thought it was going to have. But as far as her being the absolute Wonder Woman for a while, I'm not sure if I like it. I think especially after the supposed role that she had in Dark Knight's Death Metal, it's really the gap is, there's a huge gap there between the two characters, but Jones in her narration in the writing makes sure to kind of drive that point, the fact that she's a hothead, that she's unproven, that she's definitely unpolished for the role. But very curious to continue to read on. I thought it was good. I liked it. It was good.
Yeah, I didn't like it.
You didn't like it?
I didn't think. Here's the thing about a lot of the Future State books that I've read so far. I feel the art across the board has been really subpar, and I'm seeing art from artists that I know can do better, and I don't know if it's because their work is being rushed or what, but I expect more from these artists, to be honest. So it was interesting, I'll say. But I don't know. Maybe I kind of feel like I read more Wonder Woman this year than, or as much Wonder Woman this year as I've ever read. And I feel like I'm just getting to have a good feel for who Diana is. And now we're getting, based on what we saw in Death Metal, the end of that, which we didn't mention because we don't want to spoil, but now we're getting a new Wonder Woman. And, I don't know. She's not really that interesting to me.
That's what I mean. That's what I mean by there's this gap that we had Diana do all that she did for a while. And then to turn around the same week, and it's like, here's an unpolished Wonder Woman.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I get that,
you need to like, because we're going to shove her in your face in books and TV. Oh, and by the way, she's a minority, so you have to like her. And if you don't like her, you're the problem. How that's going to work.
Yeah, right? I guess that's the problem. Then the story just didn't engage me.
I know, but what I'm saying is that if you write bad about it, do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I see that. I just like, so being introduced to this new Wonder Woman, and then right away she's headed to the underworld. Like, I feel like there's nothing here for me. Like, I'm going to read it because there's only one more issue. I've already read the first one. I can't possibly see how this ends up being a satisfying story based on the amount of story we got in the first issue, though. So I feel like the Superman Wonder Woman story, which is coming next week on the book that comes out on the 12th, I thought was a lot better. But even that was still only okay.
Well, look, man, this is a Hispanic Wonder Woman. I'm going to root for her as much as I can.
No, and that's I don't think there's anything wrong with her necessarily. She is, you're right. I mean, she's very young. She's very inexperienced, except not, because supposedly she's been Wonder Woman for a long time, according to this. But she comes across as very inexperienced. Yeah, and we know we're going to see more of this character because, like Manny said, she has her own TV show in development. We're going to see more of this character by this same creator, Joelle Jones, in the Wonder Girl series that's going to start coming out probably in April. It wasn't solicited for March. So if there's somebody else who's going to be mentoring her, I think that's what she kind of needs. I feel like she's kind of a loose cannon. And you never would associate Wonder Woman with a character that is out of control. Even when it was Artemis as Wonder Woman, she still was competent, you know? And so I kind of feel like she kind of reminds me of Jason Todd when he was Robin. I mean, she's not as whiny as him, obviously. And I don't want to compare her to Damian because she's not a brat, but she does feel like a sidekick, like somebody who needs an older, more experienced hero to kind of mentor her and teach her wisdom. You know,
she feels like she belongs on the Titans.
Yeah. Or, I mean, I would even say maybe the Justice League, but you know, maybe, I mean, I could see her on the Titans, but you know, maybe the Justice League, she's older. So I could see her on the Justice League, but regardless, she does feel like she needs older heroes to be mentoring her. So she shouldn't be carrying her own book. In my opinion,
I feel like there should be a book where she's mentored by, Jessica Cruz, and it's just like Jessica Cruz like having anxiety the whole time because she keeps doing
things. You doing that?
Yeah.
All right, well, let me move on to a book that really surprised me this week in a couple ways. It's Amazing Spider-Man number 56. It's written by Nick Spencer, Mark Bagley handling the pencils. Been rumors of Bagley coming back to Amazing Spider-Man, but we've still seen Patrick Gleason on the book lately. And here's the thing about Gleason. He can draw in so many different styles. And for whatever reason, he's been drawing like Ryan Otley lately. And nothing against Ryan Otley, but I just don't like his style on Spider-Man. Was fine for Invincible. Don't like it on Spider-Man. And so to have Gleason come on and then draw like Otley was a bit disappointing. So to have Mark Bagley back, it's like breath of fresh air, good, clean art. Inks by Andrew Hennessy and John Dell. And then we had Rochelle Rosenberg and Edward Delgado on colors and Joe Caramagna on letters. So the first thing that caught me, I'm looking at the cover, the Mark Bagwell cover, and it's got Norman Osborn and and the Kingpin there, and they've each got hold of like one side of Spider-Man's mask, and they're literally ripping it in half. And I look at the number and it says issue 56, Last Remains Postmortem. So the story that's been going on lately with Kindred has been called Last Remains. Postmortem means after death, right? So I'm like, wait, the way last issue ended on a cliffhanger, we didn't get the end of Last Remains. Did I miss an issue? I know I didn't miss an issue because 55 was the last issue. And it sold out like crazy because people loved the Patrick Gleason web cover or whatever. I'm like, I didn't think it was anything special, but book's going for $20 online already. I'm like, wait, what? I'm thinking, well, maybe I'll buy a alternate cover, which is still going. I haven't picked up my issue 55 yet. I may just, when I go into the comic shop, I didn't go last week, I'll just buy the other cover of 55 that nobody cares about, and I'll just sell my 55 for $20. Because everybody seems to like it. And I'm just like, whatever, I couldn't really care less. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. That what surprised me was, wait, this is Last Remains Postmortem Part 1. Wait, so Last Remains ended? But we didn't get the end to a story. Like the story, what? Dick Spencer, what are you doing to me? You're off, man. And so, yeah, sure enough, I start reading this issue and everything's resolved. And not resolved like we know that Harry Osborn was Kindred and now he's been cured and Peter and Mary Jane are off having a picnic in the park and the Kingpin and Norman Osborn are in jail. No, not resolved like that. Like the big fight, the big climax that ended with a cliffhanger for issue 55, that's all done. We didn't get to see any of the fight. We didn't get to see anything of what happened, the resolution, none of it. And I'm going, what the heck happened? So it opens up with a flashback and then it moves forward. And when I say flashback, like flashback from before the big fight that started last issue. And then we move to present time and the fight's over. But then as you read the book, the fight and what happens is seen in flashback. And I have to say that while I'm not a big fan of this sort of non-linear storytelling, because it feels sort of like a bit of a cheat for Spencer to do it like this, like maybe he doesn't write big action well, and so he's decided to just tell it in short little snippets of flashback. It's not my favorite way for him to tell a story. But that being said, the ideas and the payoff that happens in this issue makes this probably the best issue of Amazing Spider-Man he's written since he came on the book with issue number one. So in a way, even though he sort of cheated because of the ideas and the payoff of this issue, I think it's the best issue he's done. Now, I know the bar has been kind of low. I haven't been real happy with Nick Spencer on Spider-Man, but at least this feels like Spider-Man. It looks like Spider-Man with the Bagley art. And the other thing is that the biggest complaint I've had lately about Spencer on Spider-Man is how the pacing on the book has been so terrible that we get just the tiniest little bit of story and that's it. You know, it feels like reading an issue of The Walking Dead where you have to read like four or five issues at one time to feel like the story moves at all. Well, this issue's jam-packed with stuff because you get like a full issue worth of stuff in the aftermath of the big fight, plus you get the fight or the second half of the fight in the flashback. So you get a lot of story in this issue. So I'll give Spencer credit for that. And yeah, I just think the ideas and what he has set up is really great. And I could talk about it in more detail, but I don't want to spoil. So maybe I'll do a spotlight on it later on and talk about some of the classic Spider-Man ideas and characters that you could spin off in fresh and new directions because of what Spencer has done here. So yeah, his best issue of Amazing Spider-Man so far. So I'm torn on whether I could recommend reading Last Rites, but I almost feel like this isn't the worst issue to be able to jump on because you get enough of what's been going on in this issue that you probably can jump on and be like, okay, I see what's going on. And whatever this post-mortem arc is, I think it's going to set Spider-Man up for the next foreseeable future.
And his Taskmaster costume.
And we'll figure out what's going on with that. Yeah, I keep hearing people call it the Taskmaster costume. Taskmaster is orange, and that costume is yellow. Taskmaster is blue, white, and orange. And this new Spider-Man costume is blue, white, and yellow. So I don't know why people keep saying Taskmaster.
Well, I said it because I knew it would annoy you.
Yes. Well, good job.
You're welcome.
It's a terrible looking costume, but
I don't like it.
Anyway, what do you have up next?
Up next, I have a surprise book that I really enjoyed. Scout Honor number one from Aftershocks Comics. From Aftershock Comics, it's getting late. Story by David Pepose, art by Pepose. Luca. Huh?
David Pepose.
Pepose? Oh, wow. That's a fun last name. David Pepose, art by Luca Casalanguida, colors by Matt Miller, and covers by Brent Schrubner, Andy Clark, and Jose Villarrubia. So this book takes place in a dystopian future, years after a nuclear apocalypse, where a new society has risen from the ashes, and they have decided that they're going to build their world based upon an old Ranger Scout manual. And this book is going to be following a young Ranger Scout named Kit, who has lived through going through the upbringings of all of the codes and everything from the Scout's manual. It's interesting because it gives you sometimes like Zombieland vibes, because like it'll go through different rules and things that they have to adhere to, the way they do things and things like that. And it's a really good in number one issue, obviously, where they kind of set up this world and you kind of get the feel of what it's supposed to be. And then like any good book, and it gives you a little twist, and it gives you a little bit of a spark of what are the things to come, and what is the mystery that our character is going to have to endure. There's some interesting things about Kit that I'm not going to disclose, because I think you much rather discover them on your own, and because it makes it a lot more fun. This looks like it's going to be a really, really fun book, just because I am interested to see how they keep the Scout teachings, kind of almost turning it into like that cult feel, and then this character and how she reacts to the things that happen. It's a good book. I recommend it. I think this one, it's a good story using something that we all know, recognize for, their community service or whatever, their badges.
Yeah, I did like the little twist with Kit. I love that it happened in the middle of the issue. Like usually that kind of thing is at the end and the story's over, but we got more story. And I am a fan of David Pepo's work. He had that series. It's kind of inspired by Calvin and Hobbes. That was, it's really great. Spencer and Locke, if you've never read it, it's basically Calvin and Hobbes. If they were like Calvin grew up in a broken home, and you're never quite sure. And he grows up to be a detective, and he's got all the traditional tropes of a detective, bad abusive childhood and whatever. And Hobbes is Locke is his, imaginary friend, but you're never quite sure if he's imaginary or not.
I think you're telling me about that recently, actually.
Yeah, it's a really good story. But anyway, David Pepose is a creator that I enjoy, but I don't know. This one didn't grab me. It got a lot more interesting the second, like after you had that reveal, and then the second half of the story pulled me in a little more, where I thought, maybe I'll check out issue two. But prior to that, I was like, nah, I'm not, it's not interesting to me, but I could see why some people would enjoy it. Then again, I was never a Boy Scout, so I guess we'll see what the second issue brings. All right. Speaking of independent books that really rock, next book I'm going to talk about is Crossover number 3, written by Donnie Cates, art by Jeff Shaw, colors by D. Cuniff, letters and design by John J. Hill. This book is so good. It's cool ideas. It's so meta. Like, it starts off talking, once upon a time, there was this comic book. You've probably read it or seen the show or the movie or read other comics that were inspired by it or stolen from it. And then it goes on and then it talks about that actual comic and, you know, that it makes sense when it does and it refers to it and it blends into the story. And if you're a comic book fan, you have to love what Donnie Cates is doing here, because Donnie Cates, first and foremost, is a comic book fan. So he's writing this story that is a comic that references other comics and, you know, draws and pulls in from the mythos of comics and classic stories and Crisis on Infinite Earths and Superman and Batman and all that kind of stuff. And so it's just a lot of fun as a comic fan to read this story that's engaging on its own and is an interesting story, but also is just a love letter to comics and the history of comics. And so it's one of my favorite things on the stands right now. And for the last week or so, Donnie's been teasing this big reveal that's going to show up in issue 3. Like, somebody's going to show up and it's going to be just crazy. And I didn't really think about it too much. Kind of like, huh, I wonder who it would be. There is some variant covers that have Spawn on it, drawn by Todd McFarlane. And so, you know, I think that was natural for people to think, well, maybe Spawn's going to show up. I'm not going to say who it is, but when they do show up on the last page, it is so perfect who it is. You're just like, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense. And who he is as a character and who, you know, his importance to the story, it all just makes perfect sense. And I can't wait to see what Donnie does with this character. And if you love comics and you've been, you know, reading comics for, you know, a good while, and you know the history of, you know, famous comics and how they've impacted the industry, you know, Sin City, Dark Knight Returns, you know, Secret Wars over at Marvel, then yeah, you need to read this, because it's awesome. It really, really is. And the artwork by Jeff Shaw is great. He gets to use a bunch of different styles, because we do have some supposed fictional characters, and they're fictional in the world of the comic, right? Like, they've stepped out of the pages of a comic in this comic. And you know how old comics, when they're printed on newsprint with the old style of coloring, where it was the dots, and you could see, if you looked closely at the art, you could see the little dots of color. And these, some of the drawings that Jeff Shaw does here, some of these characters, they've got all those dots on them, because the, you know, they're supposedly have stepped out of, you know, comic books of yesteryear with that style printing. So yeah, artwork is done really well. The dialogue is fun. And it's just, there are stakes to the story. Like, and you feel the, you know, the kind of tension and drama of the story, but at the same time, it's just such a love letter to comics that it's great. It's working on two levels. So I really, really, really recommend Crossover number 3. What do you have up next, Manny?
Up next, I have Future State, Something, number 1, by Ram V, with art by Mike Perkins, colors by June Chung. This one was a little strange. It was a little, well, kind of like any Swamp Thing book, really. There's a usually very dense ideas. And in this one, he's, it looks like the green has taken over the world. And now Swamp Thing and kind of his, I guess you can call him family, are in search for humans. But it looks like things are not going to get better. Things are going to get worse. But if anything, what I found really cool was the very, very descriptive anatomy of Swamp Thing and how they create human life from plants. And I thought that that probably took forever to kind of to put together. It was interesting. Nothing here really that really grabbed my attention other than that. Than the fact that, you know, I was kind of looking at that anatomy of how you know, he would be, a Swamp Thing would be built. He's not human. He's more of like the imitation of human life, but definitely a part of the green as per se.
Yeah, there's another one that I mean, I'm not a big Swamp Thing fan anyway, and I didn't think Mike Perkins' art was up to his usual standards.
Yeah, it's...
Yeah, it was tough to read. And normally I like Rambee's writing, but I think if you're a Swamp Thing fan, maybe you might enjoy it. But for me, there was...
The thing is, if you're you can't really tell a Swamp Thing story too well in two issues like that.
Yep.
And just the whole idea of how large of a scale... That you know, that they're trying to tell a story, you know, about aftermath of a war and everything, and you're introducing so many other characters from the green, or reintroducing them, it's just too dense, and then you're like, you're really not going to get anything much from one more issue.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right. Well, what am I going to talk about next? I'll talk about Juggernaut.
Ooh.
So, written by Fabian Nicieza, art by Ron Garney, colors by Matt Milla, letters by Joe Sabino. And I think after three issues, like, I'm not even sure why I read past issue two, because it was okay. But, you know, we've seen that story before. Villain, Marvel's trying to turn him into a hero. Is it working? Is it not? The Ron Garney art, it worked for me on Daredevil. But Garney, he's another one whose style has changed over the years, and his art style is much less clean than it used to be. And when he's teamed up with Matt Milla, as he is here, it works, but I think it works better on a street level character like Daredevil, where you're in Hell's Kitchen, you're in, you know, New York City, and it's urban settings, and you've got a lot of shadows and nighttime. And this has been more of sort of an adventure book. And so I don't think the art works as well here, but for whatever reason, I kept reading it. I guess it was interesting enough. And I thought it was a limited series, I think. I thought it was only five issues for some reason. And then issue four came, and Nicieza's like really got me caring about the Juggernaut. Like, the Juggernaut's always been somebody you just like, he's kind of a hothead, nothing really likable about him. And so, you know, why do I care? But with issue four, like, my hat was off to Nicieza for making me care about the Juggernaut. And that's sort of continuing here with issue five, where you really see that Cain Marco, he really is trying to turn over a new leaf. Like, he's trying to make up for the bad things that he's done in his life, and don't necessarily understand the motivation for it yet, but you got to give him credit for trying, you know? And so, I think this is a really underrated series that not enough people are talking about, of what sort of a likable character, or at least a relatable character, that Nicieza is turning the Juggernaut into. Because you think about it, like, take the Juggernaut, who's this unstoppable, really powerful character, and instead of him being somebody that's an obstacle to heroes, but turn that around and say, okay, here's a guy who is going to go after somebody who's doing nefarious things, and he can't be stopped. Like, point him at AIM, or point him at Hydra, or point him at Dr. Doom, and say, okay, the Juggernaut's coming for you, and you can't stop him. You know, he's this unstoppable force. That's
on the Juggernaut.
Yeah, exactly. And that's cool. And that's interesting. And so, even though I'm still not a big fan of the art, the series has been good. And what happens at the end of this issue five, looks like we're going to be changing the dynamic a little bit of who the Juggernaut supporting cast is going to be. And that could be, it could either work or it could maybe spin the book off in a way that I might not be necessarily as interested in reading. So I guess we'll have to see what issue six brings, but I would definitely say if you haven't been reading Juggernaut, you can pick this issue up. You don't have to have read issue 1 through 4. You can pick this issue up and get a feel for what it is now. And you'll see that twist at the end and you'll know if you want to come back for issue 6 to see where it goes or not. So, and I think the art does work. I mean, it's not my favorite Ron Garney art. I prefer his earlier style, but it does work for who the Juggernaut is as sort of a force of nature. It's kind of these big, thick lines and really grounded, solid artwork. So what do you have up next, Manny?
I have a Marvel book. I think this is the most diverse set of books I've had in a while. Usually it's so much DC, and today is a little different. So my next book is Marvel Star Wars, The High Republic, #1. This one's written by Kevan Scott with art by Ario Anindito, inked by Mark Morales, and colors by Annalisa Leone. What I like about this book is immediately in the first thing you see after the cover is a timeline. It gives you the timeline where it talks about the fall of the Jedi, which is the prequel movies, and then some of all the way over to the Rise of the First Order, and it makes sure to let you know where this book takes place, which is actually before any of that. So this is before this book takes place before this the Skywalker saga during the High Republic. So we find ourselves in an area where the Republic is currently being protected by Jedi Knights, and they're about to launch a something called the Starlight Beacon, and it's supposed to be a new space station that's supposed to serve as a kind of a symbol of hope. But it, like in any great Star Wars story, it looks like that, you know, that there may be a threat there, and it all may be coming to not an end, but something's going to happen where somebody's going to mess it up, of course. So we find a young Jedi who is training, and he's going to go through trials. But the thing about it is this beacon that they've put up has kind of is emitting a frequency that actually it might be causing some species of giant bugs to almost destroy an entire civilization of I don't even know what they're called, but they're almost like fairy type creatures. And so she decides that in order to save them, she's going to have to not complete the trial that her Jedi master has put forth for her, and instead do I guess what you would call the right thing and save the city of creatures from these alien bugs. And it was good. It seemed like it was the right thing to do. And we have a Yoda sighting in this issue as well, which is pretty cool. He's not as old, obviously. yeah, it was a good start. It's different because, but another thing I like about it is that because it's before, you know, the Skywalker saga and everything, it's a bunch of stories that they don't have to tie into anything, and it makes it I think it makes it more enjoyable. Not too bad.
Yeah, so I don't know if it's just based on all the Star Wars announcements lately that have come out, or if it's the speculator market and how much books like the first appearance of Dr. Aphra and first appearance of what's her name? Aso? Is that how you say it?
Ahsoka.
Ahsoka, yeah. Their first appearances in comics are like buku bucks now. They're big money. So for whatever reason, I mean, there's plenty of first appearances in this High Republic book, but this is like the highest selling comic in a while. And the other part of it is that Marvel tied it into this big multimedia High Republic event that went on today. Cause you know, High Republic, it has novels, it has comics, it has, you know, all kinds of stuff tied in, all kinds of other Star Wars content tied in. I think there's even a video game in the works. But they sold 200,000 copies to comic stores. It's already sold out. It went to first print, sold out before it even went on sale. Second print sold out. They printed it again. They're doing a third print. That apparently is already sold out.
Jesus.
So that, yeah, 200,000 copies to comic books and another 100,000 copies of people ordering it from the multimedia event or whatever. So Star Wars is as big as ever. I stopped following Star Trek stuff a long time ago, or Star Wars stuff rather, a long time ago. I couldn't keep up, and it wasn't, I don't know. It just didn't feel like it was good. I felt like I thought all the latest three were underwhelming, and I don't know, just kind of lost its way for me. So, but great for all the Star Wars fans out there that are loving it. And I mean, 300,000 copies. That's something. That is something else. That's really good for comics. So, whether it's good or not, I can't say. You have to take Maddie's word for it, because I didn't read it. All right, let me move on to my next book. Also a Marvel book. It's Spider-Woman, and this is issue. What issue is this? Issue number 8. Written by Carla Pacheco. Art is by Pierre Perez. Colors by Frank DiArmada. Letters by Travis Lanham. Man, is this book fun? Is it good? Is it Jessica Drew at her badassness best? Yes, it's all those things. It's great dialogue from Carla Pacheco. Jessica is not in good shape. She's sort of been telling the same underlying story for the first couple arcs here, where, you know, Jessica, she gets her powers from radiation, right? Like her body and blood was irradiated. But then she has a healing factor that keeps that radiation that gave her powers from like harming her. Well, basically, because other members of her family kind of have the same genetic situation set up, where their cells are breaking down, even though they weren't exposed to radiation at the beginning of the series, Jessica's healing factor was removed so they could try to study the healing factor and then give that healing factor to other members of her family so they would not die, including Jessica's own son, which is why Jessica kind of went along with it. Well, now that she doesn't have her healing factor, she's dying, and she's been taking this experimental serum to try to keep her alive, but the serum makes her unstable and really violent, and she, last issue, lashed out and punched Captain Marvel, Carol Danvers, her best friend, and it was a whole thing. And so she's been searching for a cure. And at the end of last issue, we saw that Carol Danvers and a bunch of the other heroes actually imprisoned Jessica. We're like, we're putting you, we're sticking you in this containment vessel to keep you from hurting any of us or yourself, because we got to go off and fight this King in Black null guy right now. And we'll come back and help you when we're done saving the world from all the symbiotes that are attacking. And that's where it was left off. Well, that's where Jessica starts this issue, being imprisoned, but it's not where she ends the issue. And it's another issue where Jessica is teaming up with somebody that she doesn't necessarily want to team up with, but out of necessity does. And the interaction between those two characters, the dialogue and the banter back and forth between those two characters is really fun. And there's a lot of great action from Pierre Perez. Great art, great line work. I always love Pierre's faces. I've been a big fan of him ever since he did the Archer and Armstrong series, when that series relaunched from Valiant Entertainment, when they started back up. I think it was 2013 or 2014. They brought Archer and Armstrong back, And yeah, he does facial expressions really, really well. And then we get a last page reveal that's fun. And yeah, I'm just really loving this book. And this one, kind of like MODOK, kind of like Juggernaut, I don't hear enough people talking about how great Spider-Woman is. It is so good right now. Like, this is a book, if you love Marvel Comics, if you love action comics, superhero comics, this is everything that comics should be. Great art, great dialogue. The color work is outstanding. Like, it just, it works on every level, you know. And I'm not even a big Spider-Woman fan. You know, I picked up the first issue just because it had a cool cover. It was a, like a die cut cover. And I read it and I'm like, oh, this is pretty good. Let me see where it goes. And, you know, each successive issue, it's just been getting better and better. So hats off to Carla Pacheco and the whole creative team. It's been a really, 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 really good series. So, all right, Manny, you have one more book?
Yep, I got one more book. And that's going to be Future State, the next Batman, number one, written by John Ridley with art by Nick Darrington. And then there's also inside Outsiders by Brandon Thomas and Sumit Kumar with Jordi Belair on colors. And then there's also an Arkham Knights by Paul Jenkins and Jack Herbert. I'm not sure really what to say much about this. It's kind of all over the place, I felt. I don't really feel like it introduces Tim Fox as the new Dark Knight in a very good way.
Call him Jace. It's not me.
Yeah, well,
I'm not the next Batman.
I saw that and I was like, Jace is going to say that they did this for him.
No.
So, like, they didn't really introduce him very well. He has issues with his family. They kind of gloss over the fact that Bruce Wayne is missing. The only thing really that is concrete in this issue, and that it's been the thing in any of the issues that take place in Gotham, is that the magistrate is on everybody, and then they're going to be taking in anybody who has masks, any vigilantes, and there's a little part where I guess now there's like a Bane section where he has a gang, or future Banes. I don't know what you want to call them. And like, they have to do like the petty crimes, or like kind of like blood in, blood out. And that's really it. Like, it was for as good as a writer that I know John Ridley is, I really felt like this was, I think it's part of what Jace has been saying this whole time, that this was supposed to be 5G and it's supposed to be a grander idea and go on. But now you just have a couple of issues to figure it all out. So it just didn't work for me. And nothing happened. That's really how I feel. The Outsiders one had a cool idea, but same thing. It was kind of short. I am very curious as to the finale of that issue, as to what happened, because it's one of my favorite characters. And then I don't even know what the heck. I don't know how to describe the final one, which is Arkham Knights. I mean. The Arkham Knight was a cool concept for the video game way back when, in the game Arkham Knights, where they swore to everybody that it wasn't, you know, that it wasn't who it was. And then in the comics for Batman Detective 1000, I'm sorry, we saw that the Arkham Knight was finally going to be introduced in comics, and that was kind of lackluster. And this one, same thing. There's this like now, like I guess like a cult of Arkham Knights that are made up of like what, Two-Face, Victor Zsasz, who else was there? Clayface, I think it was.
Yeah.
Tweedledum and
Dr. Phosphorus.
That's Dr. Phosphorus. And they spent so much time on Dr. Phosphorus is in pain. Like, that's the only thing I remember from that. Because they kept talking about it. And I was like, is this important for some reason? And then they recruit Killer Croc, which, you know, is a great addition to any team if he decides that he wants to join.
I don't know. So, I thought that the Arkham Knight story was far and away the best story in this book, the one that I enjoyed the most.
It was more complete as far as like getting your idea together.
I mean, it's Paul Jenkins writing it, so mm-hmm. You know, the other two are beginners compared to him. But I will say, are you looking at it right now? The Arkham Knight story?
No.
Okay. Because the Peacekeeper, you know, the magistrate has like these leaders or whatever. They're called Peacekeepers, and they wear these like helmets. They have numbers, you know, Peacekeeper 1, Peacekeeper 8, Peacekeeper 12. They have these helmets and like the American flag and other stickers, whatever. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that that story that Brian Edward Hill did for Top Cow? I can't even remember what the...
Oh, yeah, I know exactly. Crossbones. Is it? No, Crossbones.
No, it wasn't called, but something like that. But yeah, that's what these Peacekeepers remind me of with their helmets. Bone, you're right. It's Bone something. Head Bone. Let me look it up real fast. But yeah, that's what these Peacekeepers remind me of.
Bonehead.
Bonehead, that's it, yeah. Yeah, that's what they remind me of.
They look a lot like that. Yeah.
But yeah, but like the main story, I am not the next Batman. So let me get that out right now. Even though, like Manny said, the new guy, it's Tim Fox. And when his brother Luke, who supposedly was going to be the next Batman, and everybody bought his Batwing issue and it went for crazy amounts of money, and then it turned out it wasn't him. So Luke calls him Tim. He says, "Don't call me Tim. Call me Jace." Like, wait, what? What? That makes no. Yeah. Like, what? Why just? How do you get Jace out of Tim? Like, whatever. It's not me. For some reason, he wants to be called Jace. It's retarded, but whatever. But the other part about it is Nick Darrington art. And remember how I was saying before, like, I'm seeing artists like Joel Jones and like Eddie Barrows and like Nick Darrington, who I expect to see really good quality art. Mm-hmm. Dude, the art for that first story.
I agree.
It looks so rushed and so, I mean, I don't want to say it's bad art, but it's not up to the usual standards of what I expect from Nick Darrington. So yeah, I feel like it was paced okay, but it was kind of boring. Didn't really bring any emotional stakes. And the most disappointing part about it, like Manny said, we know John Ridley can bring that stuff. Look at the first issue of the other history of the DC Universe. So it was spectacular. One of the best books of 2021 or 2020 rather. Okay. And, you know, then to have this, it's like, it's just disappointing. This is like, this issue is everything that's wrong with Future State so far for me. Like, I was talking to somebody else about it, tonight, and what their grade would be for it and what my grade would be. And this is a guy who's really harsh on comics, and his grade was actually higher than mine. So you'll have to, I'm not going to give my grade out here. You'll have to tune in to Future State Friday next week when we go over the book in detail. But yeah, it was a disappointment overall. So let me move on to my last book, which is Generations Shattered number one. It's written by Dan Jurgens, Andy Schmidt, and Robert Venditti. We have art from a whole host of artists, Ivan Reis and Joe Prado, Ivan Reis and Scott Hanna, Fernando Passerin and Eau Claire Albert, Aaron Lopresti and Matt Ryan. Emmanuel Lupacchino and Wade Von Grobiger, Bernard Chang, Yannick Paquette, Kevin Nolan, Dan Juergens and Klaus Janson, Paul Pelletier and Sandra Hope, John Romita Jr. and Danny Mickey, Doug Braithwaite, Rags Morales, Dan Juergens and Klaus Janson again, and then Mike Perkins finishes it up. Colors are by Hi-Fi, letters are by Tom Napolitano, and all I can say about the art is almost overwhelmingly the art in this book is really spectacular. It's traveling through different periods of time in the DC universe, so that's how they kind of make all these different art styles work. The only bad thing about it is the fact that JRJR got 7 whole pages. Some of these other guys only got a couple. I would have liked to have seen that flipped, but I guess if you're paying John Romita Jr., you want him to work, even though his work isn't very good. But you remember earlier when I was talking about Dark Knight's Death Metal number 7 and about how messy that event is?
Yep.
Then I read this event. Because this was supposed to be an event, right? So this was supposed to be the Generation 0 and then Generation 1 through 5 one-shots that were going to explain how we go from, you know, the current Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman, and Flash, and Green Lantern, and whoever else was going to get replaced, and how all those replacements happen. So how does Tim Fox or Luke Fox or whoever take over for Bruce Wayne? How does John Kent take over for Superman? How does Yara Flor take over for Wonder Woman? Like, this was what was supposed to happen. We were supposed to get a one shot on Free Comic Book Day in May, and then another one shot in June for Generation 1, and then Generation 2 would have been July, 3 would have been August, 4 would have been in September, and then Generation 5 would have been October, and that's when we would have got the 5G stuff starting in October or the end of September. So roughly that's what was supposed to happen. Well, Dan DiDio got fired. That whole plan got thrown out the window. They repurposed all the already created 5G content and turned it into 2 issues of Future State, except for the Batman books, which are getting 4 issues. And they've repurposed what work was done on those Generation 1 shots into this, into Generation Shattered. And then we're going to get another issue called, another one shot next month called Generation Forged. So this, what was supposed to be a big event has been condensed down into 2 issues. How it fits into the DC universe and Infinite Frontier remains to be seen. But what I loved about the book is that you've got some veteran comic writers like Dan Juergens and Andy Schmidt and Robert Venditti that are telling an event story that makes sense. And they don't even have 7 issues. They don't even have 7 issues like Scott Snyder did to tell this story. They're doing it in 2 issues, and the thing that's cool is they're not trying to do too much. They're just taking the characters that are in the story, and they're not pulling in all this other stuff. They're not trying to, you know, explain why does the entire DC universe look different? Why, you know, let's have Batman amalgamated with all these other characters. No, they're just telling the story about these particular events, this particular, for lack of a better term, crisis. I can't believe it's not called like Generational Crisis Shattered or something like that, because it is very much a crisis. Like, there's a big wave of what they call goneness. You know, in the Crisis on Infinite Earth story, it was the antimatter wave, that white that would come and erase everything from existence. And this is sort of a time wave where everything is being erased. And we do get a reveal right at the end of kind of who's behind it. And yeah, there's only one other issue. And I'm kind of disappointed. I mean, as much as I wasn't excited for 5G and I didn't want to see Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman and Flash and Green Lantern and all of them get replaced, because we know that they're not going to stay replaced. We know Bruce Wayne's going to come back and be Batman. We know Clark Kent's going to come back and be Superman. The properties are too valuable to Warner Brothers to not have that happen. So in a way, I almost feel like, why are you bothering to do this? I would have liked to have seen that if it was this story, like I would have liked to have seen it in its original iteration, like what was going to happen, because this is interesting. This is good. This is the best DC comic far and away that I read this week. It is just, it's 80 pages and it's got some really great characters, you know, Batman, which we saw in, I guess it was in the, Batman anniversary, the issue 1027, supposedly the 1000th issue of Batman, which is actually because he first appeared in Detective in 27. So actually it's 1001 if you count issue numbers, but then annuals and specials and all that. So it's not really. But anyway, we did get a generational Batman story there where we kind of saw this, where kind of the first generation of Batman, where he looks kind of like how Bob Kane first drew him, with the really long ears and narrow face and what have you. We did see that story kind of already. And then we see it again from a different perspective here. And we get to see like a really old Booster Gold and, you know, a Superboy and, you know, Teen Titans from a certain age. So it's definitely a time travel story, and they're pulling in heroes from all different time periods of the DC universe. And so it's a fun walk, and it's nostalgic. It's a fun walk down memory lane that way. And it's just the best thing about it is I was sitting there reading it, and I'm thinking, okay, I don't know if I read it last. I think I read Death Metal first, and then I read a few Future State issues, and then I read this, Generations Shattered. And I'm like, okay, I read this end of this messy event that Snyder and the other creators kind of made work in its own way, but it still was kind of messy. And then I read these Future State books that were subpar and didn't really make sense to me, and felt like the pacing, and they're trying to cram too much story in. And again, I don't necessarily blame the creators. It's kind of tough because they had all these big ideas and they're trying to cram them in just a couple books. And then I read this, and these creators had the same challenge, right? They're trying to cram something that was supposed to be 5 one-shots into 2 one-shots, but it feels so clean. Like, they did such a great job. And when you talk about really great writers like Dan Jurgens and Robert Venditti, I'm not as familiar with Andy Schmidt's work, but Venditti managed to take Hawkman and his crazy convoluted continuity and make it work. And Dan Jurgens is just a, you know, things he's done on Superman over the years, and Booster Gold and Captain America and Thor. I mean, he's a legend. And so it's no surprise that they were able to do this and do it so well. And it was just it was so refreshing after reading Death Metal and reading those Future State books to then read this and be reminded, oh yeah, this is what a good comic book story is like. This is what great artwork is like. I would have loved to have seen Yvonne Reese do all the art, or Aaron Lopresti do all the art, or Paul Pelletier, but I mean, that's just a personal thing. Those are artists whose styles I prefer. Even the Fernando Passerin stuff, when I read the John Romita Jr. pages, it did pull me out of the story a little bit, because I'm like, oh man, this art is so subpar compared to the other pages. It's kind of disappointing. But yeah, how this gets folded into Future State and Death Metal and Infinite Frontier remains to be seen. But it would have been interesting to see how it all would have played out had Dan Didio not left. Because again, I'm sort of torn. I'm glad that that replacement of heroes didn't happen, but this seems like it would have been a really cool event. And it still seems like it's going to be a cool event. It's just obviously going to be a lot different than what they originally had in mind. So I know you didn't get a chance to read it, Manny, but you definitely need to check it out, because it's really good. I know it's always a matter of how much time, and we've already talked about 16 books here, and it is 80 pages. So anyway, let me give a rundown on some of the other books you might want to be interested in picking up. We mentioned a couple of titles from Aftershock. There's also a trade paperback and a hardback that I want to mention. Join the Future from Zach Kaplan, trade paperback, collects all 5 issues of that series, is out today. There's also a Cullen Bunn series called All My Little Demons. The entire series is collected in an omnibus hardcover that is out from Aftershock today as well. We've got from Ahoy Comics, Wrong Earth Night and Day, number one. So the Wrong Earth has been a really well-received, critically acclaimed title from Ahoy. So they're going back to that world with a new series starting up. At DC, in addition to the books that we mentioned, we've also got, where is it? I know there was something. Oh, The Dreaming Waking Hours. number 6 of 12. I haven't been reading that, but people are just singing its praises and talking about how good the Dreaming is. So that is G. Willow Wilson. So if you're at all interested in the Sandman universe, you definitely want to check that out. Over at Image, we have the end of Cena Grace and Omar Spahi, Getting It Together, number 4 of 4, which that was a good read. I read it, and slice of life kind of stuff. And the creators of that are waiting to see how the trade goes before they decide if we're going to get more. But the sales of the single issues, according to the little essay they wrote in the back, really surpassed their expectations. So hoping we get more of that. It's pretty good. Also, Inkblot number 5 from Emma Kubert is out, as well as the latest issue of Walking Dead Deluxe, number 6. And if you're not familiar, it's basically Robert Kirkman re-releasing The Walking Dead, but this time in color. They've all been colored by Dave McKay, which, man, Robert Kirkman, what a genius. He's got to just pay Dave McKay to color them. All the other work is done, and he's selling for $4 each. And going to re-release the whole series 2 a month. I mean, what a money-making prospect that is. So Marvel Comics, like Manny said, there's 40 covers of Eternals number 1. It's going down my list. It's just listed over. You know, it's a lot of covers when they go, because usually the way they designate, it's cover A, cover B, cover C, right? So we go all the way from A all the way to Z, and then we have ZA, ZB, ZC, all the way down to ZL, as well as Never Die, Never Win edition. There also is a monster size hardcover of the Eternals by Jack Kirby that's on sale today if you want to go back and read that classic stuff for $125. Guardians of the Galaxy number 10 is out. We've got Iron Man number 5 I talked about. King in Black, that event is still continuing. We've got a new miniseries spinning out of that called King in Black, Return of the Valkyries, number 1 of 4. Rise of Ultraman, that series is coming to an end. I fell off. It just wasn't doing it for me. But I know a lot of people are enjoying it. So that series is coming to an end with issue number 5. We've got, speaking of Star Wars number 10. The latest series is up to double digits. Thor number 11 from Donny Cates is out. We've got Venom number 32, also from Donny Cates. And then over in the X-Men corner of the universe, X-Factor number 6 is out from Marvel Comics as well. And that's it. So those are some other titles that you may want to be on the lookout for. As far as books of the week, you have one that stands out, Manny, that you want to call out for your book of the week?
Nope.
Oh, man. So I'm going to take advantage of Manny not calling out a book of the week and do something I don't think I've ever done before. I've given out co-books of the week before, but I've never given it out to three because I really...
Oh, my God.
I can't choose. I really can't choose. So, you know, normally I would say book of the week, if you can only buy one book, buy this, but hopefully you can.
If you can only buy one book of the three, which one would it be?
I don't know. I don't know. I really don't. I guess I would have to give the slight, very, very slight edge to Generation Shattered, but only because I'm slightly more of a DC guy these days than I am a Marvel guy. But I also think that Spider-Woman is absolutely amazing. It's just as good as Generation Shattered, but in a different way. And I think Crossover by Donny Cates is just as good as Generation Shattered and just as good as Spider-Woman, but in a different way. So I'm giving you a Marvel book of the week, a DC book of the week, and an independent book of the week. All three are deserving of your attention and picking them up. So Generation Shattered number 1, Spider-Woman number 8, Crossover number 3. They're all really, really great. I highly recommend all of them. And definitely give them a chance. At least pick them up and look through them at your local comic shop. So that's going to do it for this episode. Hope you all enjoyed it as always. Any final words, Manny?
Nope, not today.
All right, everybody. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Thanks for listening, as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.